ticklish business any way you look at it. Come on, we'll stick together.
It's Ticklish Business, the podcast devoted to honoring and deconstructing the world of classic cinema. As always, I'm your host, Kristen Lopez. This week, Casey Kilmar once again joins me to conclude our tribute to Leonard Bernstein as we look at the only feature film that he made an original composition for, 1954's On the Waterfront.
He's my lead bird. He's always on top of the perch. You know, if another bump tries to come along and take his place, he really lets him have it.
Even pigeons aren't peaceful.
It's impossible to talk about On the Waterfront without talking about the events that inspired it, namely HUAC, the House Un-American Activities Committee. Founded in 1938, HUAC started out bent on rooting fascist organizations and other leftist groups that it had assumed was going on secretly in America. Predominantly, it was feared that leftists in Hollywood were going to subliminally corrupt Americans with secret communist messages in their films. The group didn't have much heft in the beginning, with rancor starting up immediately between party lines on whether it was invading people's privacy or not. But in the wake of World War II and the chronic fear of espionage, HUAC received greater prominence and funding. By the 1950s, HUAC was sending out subpoenas to anyone who had even a whiff of communistic ties. Those who refused to answer questions or name names often found themselves in contempt of court and in prison, like Dalton Trumbo. Anyone who decided to plead the fifth was assumed to have communist ties of some sort, or at least knowledge. Many in Hollywood found their careers abruptly killed as a result of refusing to name people, or those who were named by others. By the 60s, though, HUAC had lost its luster before ceasing operations completely in 1975, but not before scores of Hollywood directors, producers, screenwriters, actors, and actresses never worked again.
They better wise up. Taking Joey Doyle's life to stop him from testifying is a crucifixion. And dropping a sling on K.O. Dugan because he was ready to spill his guts tomorrow, that's a crucifixion. And every time the mob puts the crusher on a good man, tries to stop him from doing his duty as a citizen, it's a crucifixion. And anybody who sits around and lets it happen, keeps silent about something he knows has happened, shares the guilt of it just as much as the Roman soldier who pierced the flesh of our Lord to see if he was dead.
In 1952, director Elia Kazan went before HUAC, naming 8 former communists, and became one of the most controversial figures in Hollywood at the time. Some praised him as a hero, others refused to acknowledge his work because he was perceived to be a rat. Before testifying, he and collaborator Arthur Miller had crafted a script for a film called The Hook, an earlier take on what we now know as On the Waterfront. Harry Cohn of Columbia Pictures loved the script, but didn't like that the villains were corrupt union officials, so he asked if they could be changed to communists. When Kazan demanded that Miller make the revisions, the playwright turned him down, and the two went their separate ways. Miller, himself disgusted by HUAC's methods, would make his own allegory about the events, the hit stage play The Crucible, released the same year as On the Waterfront. Miller and Kazan never really repaired their friendship, but Kazan kept at it and brought on Bud Schulberg to write a new script that blended real issues regarding whistleblowing and corruption in the longshoreman trade with a healthy dose of patriotism and goodwill towards a government entity that was closely seen to be HUAC.
Well, some people just got faces that stick in your mind.
Remember, you were in trouble all the time.
Now you got me. Why, the way those sisters used to whack me, I don't know what. They thought they was going to beat an education into me, but I foxed them.
Frank Sinatra was initially offered the role of ex-boxer turned moral hero Terry Molloy. Sinatra started prepping based on a handshake deal, even going so far as to have his costumes fitted. But Kazan favored Brando and knew that a big name like his would open the door for a better budget and promotion. So actor Carl Malden filmed a secret screen test to showcase another star. Now there are two reasons here, neither one of which is confirmed or 100% true. One is that the secret screen test was meant to show producer Sam Spiegel that a, quote, more Brando-like actor was needed for Terry. The other story is that they hoped the screen test would get back to Brando and stoke his jealousy. Regardless of which story is true, the whole thing worked. Spiegel put out the offer to Brando, Brando accepted it, and Frank Sinatra hated Brando so much for taking his role that it led to some fireworks when the two actors eventually did work together on the 1955 musical Guys and Dolls, a film that Sinatra also felt Brando took his role. Oh, and the young actor who was considered Brando-like in that secret screen test, a neophyte performer named Paul Newman.
You ratted on us, Terry!
I was ratting on myself all them years. I didn't even know it.
Come on!
You think you're God Almighty, but you know what you are?
Come on!
You're a cheap, lousy, dirty, stinking mug! And I'm glad what I've done to you! You hear that? I'm glad what I've done!
Filmed over just 36 days in various parts of New Jersey, On the Waterfront received critical praise and $4.2 million at the American box office in 1954. The film won 8 Oscars, including Best Picture, Director, Lead Actor, and Supporting Actress. Unfortunately, though, Leonard Bernstein's score was nominated, but it didn't win, leaving him to stick to crafting music on stage. And hopefully, based on the clips that I've included, you'll be able to notice that he should have won for that score. Kazan said about the film, quote, "As Terry Molloy, I represented the spirit of the brave, courageous man who defied evil, but it always left him as an outsider. When Kazan was given a Lifetime Achievement Oscar in 1998, people still felt that he didn't deserve it for his comments during HUAC. Even now, Kazan remains a controversial figure to those in Hollywood." When we come back, Casey Kilmar joins me to discuss more about 1954's On the Waterfront.
So what happens? He gets the title shot outdoors in a ballpark, and what do I get? A one-way ticket to Palookaville. You was my brother, Charlie. You should have looked out for me a little bit. You should have taken care of me just a little bit so I wouldn't have to take them dives for the short-end money.
Well, I had some bets down for you. You saw some money.
You don't understand. I could have had class. I could have been a contender. I could have been somebody instead of a bum. Which is what I am.
Okay, we are back with our second episode honoring composer Leonard Bernstein, and once again I am joined by Casey Kilmar. Casey, how are you?
Doing just fine. How are you?
I am good. I'm excited to be done with Leonard Bernstein. As much as I enjoy his movies, not exactly the funnest films to talk about, as we will be discussing. We are talking, of course, today about 1954's On the Waterfront, otherwise known as the only movie Leonard Bernstein created music for other times Hollywood adapted his work. It's going to be a downer of an episode. This, of course, stars Marlon Brando, Carl Malden, Lee J. Cobb, and Eva Marie Saint. Casey, what is your background with this? Because I've seen this movie. This is the third time I've seen this. I feel nothing for it.
I saw it actually for the first time at the TCM Film Fest, I think in 2015.
Best way to see any movie.
Yeah, so that was the first time I saw it. This is only the second time I've seen it. I don't really care for the movie, to be honest. It's well made. It's a great film, but it's boring. And I'm not a huge fan.
Which is going to make for a really great conversation, I think. You always get movies, certain movies that feel like totems that you have to love, like Citizen Kane. You have to love it. If you don't, then there's something wrong with you. I feel like On the Waterfront is that same type of movie where it's just so universally critically praised and elevated as this film that you have to love. That if you don't, we thought West Side Story felt a little dated, and that was in 1961. I don't know how I feel On the Waterfront holds up to audiences that are younger than us.
Yeah, I'm not sure that people younger than us would even consider watching it. I watched it with a friend of mine who is older than me by a couple years, and she was bored out of her mind.
In case people don't know what the plot is, it tells the story of Marlon Brando's character, Terry Molloy. He is an ex-prize fighter who essentially took a dive and is now a longshoreman. He is confronted with being a canary, quote unquote, and ratting out the mob who is controlling the docks. The gateway to that is the death of this young man who apparently was the nicest guy in the world, because that's all we know about him. And his sister, played by Eva Marie Saint, is the girl left behind. I guess it helps that we give Terry something to ease his troubles. He questions whether he's going to testify or not. At least that's how I look at Eva Marie Saint's character. We can talk about her purpose in this movie in a second. Right off the bat, did you know when you watched this the first time that it was about HUAC, the House and American Activities Committee?
Yeah, the first time I watched it, I had no idea that it was supposed to be about that. I'm pretty sure the reason I went to see it was because Eva Marie Saint was introducing it.
That's a good reason to see any movie, really. Right? Eva Marie Saint is amazing.
She's great. No, I didn't know about that. I wasn't even entirely familiar with Huex until we were going to be discussing this movie. I hadn't really researched it. I didn't know a whole lot about it. Watching it the second time, knowing more about Huex and the movie was supposed to be about that, you definitely watch it with different eyes. You can definitely see it. You can see the comparison there.
For people who don't know, Elia Kazan, when he went in front of the House and American Activities Committee in the 50s, he named 8 names. Not nearly as much as other people, but he did name names, which was the apotheosis of being a horrible person in Hollywood. Because at the time, people's lives were being destroyed by these allegations. You could have just attended a meeting. You could have been listed on their magazine as being friendly, and that was enough to get you blackballed as a communist. I think we all elevate Dalton Trumbo as this success story, this poor guy who clawed his way up from being blacklisted and eventually got this second chance. But I always think of like real horror stories from HUAC, like Dorothy Comingore. When I interviewed Ileana Douglas, when I talked about Trailblazing Women, she tells the story a lot better than I do. Dorothy Comingore was in Citizen Kane, was cited as a communist, blacklisted, and that led to her having her children taken away from her by her husband.
Oh, wow.
And then she ended up dying horribly destitute, and her life was destroyed. So I always think about that when I think of people who were sympathetic witnesses. There are still people today that despise Elia Kazan. I know that I was on Twitter the other day looking at, I think it was director Joe Carnahan's Twitter, and he was talking about how he never watches an Elia Kazan film because Elia Kazan named names. I mean, it still resonates with people. It is insane. And watching On the Waterfront, I had watched it in film class the first time. And so I knew it was about HUAC. And I think that that helps, but it also removes you from enjoying the movie on its own merits, because I was watching it always looking for the subtext. And I don't think it's really subtext. It's pretty overt. Terry questioning whether he's going to testify. And at the end of the movie, when he says, "I'm glad I did it," Elia Kazan's actually quoted as saying, "That was my response. That was my response to Hollywood." And it plays as like a screw you. The hawks and the pigeons metaphor that is beaten over your head. In that regard, it's interesting. It's an interesting time capsule of a film. And it does explain Kazan's motivation to testify that he felt, and a lot of people who did testify felt, that communism was going to come in and it was going to destroy families. It was going to lead to murders and chaos in the streets. A bit overzealous. Knowing that the film is about HUAC, Elia Kazan asked Arthur Miller originally to write the script. Arthur Miller, who was not really cool with the whole HUAC group, refused to make the gangsters communist. Kazan wanted this to be an attack on Arthur Miller eventually when he got Bud Schulberg to write the script, because around the same time this came out, Arthur Miller had wrote The Crucible, which is another big HUAC text.
Yeah, I didn't know that either. I love The Crucible.
The Crucible is fantastic. So I think that it's great to play those two off, but for you watching it now, who do you think are the villains of this movie? Because I think that that's really interesting, who you're supposed to root for, knowing that this is about one guy who named names.
Personally, the gangsters are the villains. I'm not necessarily condoning tattletales, but if it's hurting people, then I think it's good to, for lack of a better word, out someone. They're not doing good things. If they were doing fantastic things, if they were Robin Hood, then yeah, don't out them. Let them continue to do good things. But with the gangsters, they were not good people. They were killing people. Good people. In this sense, I think that they are the villains, and Terry is a hero.
Bud Schulberg wrote the script, and he had a lot of issues himself within Hollywood because he had published What Makes Sammy Run, which is a searing indictment of Hollywood at the time. There is sensitivity to some of those characters. Marlon Brando's brother, played by Rod Steiger, is very pathetic. He feels very bad that he's forced his brother into this life of poverty and being this sad sack who, borrow the line, could have been a contender. You feel for his character.
You gotta say it right, Kristen.
I can't do the Brando voice.
You can. Do it.
I have some integrity, Casey. I have to keep it. You also feel bad for Eva Marie Saint. If anything, I'm really interested with how they present the committee that he's testifying against, because they're just there. They're not necessarily good or bad. They're just waiting. It's this very ominous presentation that he's, the fact that it's played alongside Carl Malden's character, who is a priest. It's almost like this tribunal, like he's being judged to go to heaven or hell. It becomes solemn and strange. And I was waiting for maybe there to be more of a question of making the committee look like gods, that these were just the nice people that were going to come in and save the day, stop the corruption. And really, the movie ends with the common man, the horde of longshoremen going into work and pushing Johnny Friendly, Lee J. Cobb's character, aside. It's not really Johnny Friendly getting arrested, which I thought was what was going to happen, but the law was going to persevere. And the law doesn't. The common man does it. It could have been more overt in promoting this message that you act good, commies bad. It does a nice blend of trying to be neutral in some areas. We talked about sharks and jets last time. We're talking about hawks and pigeons today. Do you think this movie is dated better or worse than West Side Story?
Yeah, that's tough, because in West Side Story, we're talking about teenagers, and in this one, it's adults, and it's a little bit different, so it's not as humorous. It's not humorous at all, actually.
There's no weird homoeroticism jokes I can make about this movie.
No, unfortunately. Can you imagine making those about Marlon Brando?
It's not in this movie. I could definitely think of a couple Marlon Brando. I mean, have you seen Guys and Dolls?
Oh, man.
Have you seen Guys and Dolls?
I have not.
Oh, Marlon Brando sings and dances. It's really a combination of everything we've been talking about. I can't promise you that he sings well, but he sings. It's weird. I almost wish that I didn't know it was about UF when I watched it the first time, because I do think that that makes you feel like, okay, this is this moment in time when we all went crazy and now we're not. It's fixed. You're seeing, I think, especially today with our current politics and, you know, Russia and everything. It's not necessarily a Red Scare, but it is harkening back to that. I think On the Waterfront plays timely, but at the same time, it's still very much of that post-HUAC fervor.
It's still a relevant movie. The point of it is still relevant. Whereas West Side Story, it's like we said, it's another Romeo and Juliet, been done so many times.
West Side Story is timeless in that it's Romeo and Juliet, but it's so dated in how it presents that story.
Right.
I don't know about you, but I'm a Brando fan. Early Brando, once we get into some of the later Brando stuff, I tend to lose interest. But Marlon Brando had had a lot of success with Elia Kazan 3 years before this, when he had debuted Streetcar Named Desire. But he refused this role. He didn't want it. This role was originally written for John Garfield, who had dealt with HUAC himself. But John Garfield, who had been so demoralized by HUAC and the constant badgering, ended up having a massive heart attack and died.
Oh, wow.
There's arguments on the internet that Eva Marie Saint's character's brother is supposed to be a stand-in for John Garfield. That concept of this nice guy who's been driven over the edge by communism. So I don't know if I necessarily believe that, but that's an argument people have made. When John Garfield died, they offered it to Brando. Brando didn't want it. So they offered it to Frank Sinatra. And Frank Sinatra actually started prepping for this movie. They got pretty far into production before Brando got it. How do we feel about Frank Sinatra? I mean, Frank Sinatra did dramas, but this drama?
No. Just no. This is not going to be a popular comment, probably, but I'm not a big Sinatra fan. I feel like he was a jerk.
Great Sounds appropriate.
Singer, not a fan. I mean, and he's so scrawny. Like, can you imagine him trying to be a fighter? No, I can't imagine that. It would look silly. It wouldn't look right. And can you imagine him getting Eva Marie Saint? How he got Ava Gardner, I don't know.
I mean, I can see why he would want it. He had done From Here to Eternity, which was his first real test of being a dramatic actor the year before. But in 1954, he did Young at Heart, and he also did Suddenly, which Suddenly, if memory serves, is a drama noir. He was trying to expand, but yeah, I have to agree with you. I don't see him as Terry Molloy, not just because he doesn't have the body type to be a former boxer or a longshoreman, but there's right. always this air of cool, or at least command, with Sinatra. I mean, he was the chairman of the board. I don't believe that he's going to be this guy that's suffering from moral ambiguity. Do I do this? Do I not? I believe he would be like Johnny Friendly. He'd be like flipping the coin. Brando has that right blend of sensitivity and strength. They actually had to do a screen test and perform a scene from the movie to convince Brando to take the role, because they wanted him to get so jealous of what he was missing that they did right. this screen test with Carl Malden and a young actor named Paul Newman. And Brando got so jealous about Paul Newman that he took this role. Now, do we think, had history been different, Paul Newman would have been good in here?
I do. I think that he would have been able to play it off well. He has the right face for it. Not quite as well as Brando, because Brando has a little bit more of that toughness. But I think that Newman would have been good. He would have been able to play the sensitive, I don't know what to do type of character that Brando plays so well.
If you look at his performance in Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, that malaise, that freeze, where he doesn't know what to do, so he doesn't do anything, that would have been really emotionally complex. Because a lot of Brando's acting, it's hard for Brando to come into a room and not feel like he's going to be like the Kool-Aid man and go through a wall. He's got that intimidation factor, and you understand why yeah. he's used his muscle for these guys. Newman has the shrewdness to him, but it's approachable. He looks like a good boy, but he's mm-hmm. also a good boy that you know could probably hold his own. I think yeah. it would have been interesting to see. How do you feel about Marlon Brando in this?
In what sense? I mean, I think he does well with it.
I like him as a performer in this. I love his little bits of stage business that he does. If you look at a lot of Brando's films, he always does weird little things that you don't really understand why he's doing them, but they just are really cute and they increase the character. Like in The Wild One, there's a scene where the woman is like, I think she's washing down a lunch counter, and the way he just lifts his hand is very, it's something you're not going to notice, but it makes the scene distinctive.
I think I know what you're going for here. It's the part where he and Eva Marie Saint are walking, and he just randomly, she starts to put her gloves on, and he just takes one of them and puts them on for whatever reason. What is he doing? Look at it. That's so hilarious and adorable. He's acting like a teenage boy. I think it makes you sympathize with his character even more. It makes him human.
He walks around with this glove on his hand, which it's a small glove. He's got a big hand. I don't know how it fits. It doesn't rip or anything.
Either.
It's the weirdest thing. The way that it's acting as a symbol, if you don't feel that their relationship has any build to it before, the fact that they're both wearing half of this glove speaks volumes about their connection to each other. And yeah, it does bring up his childlike innocence. The only person that he has in his life is his brother. I mean, I guess I could make a homoerotic joke, but I won't. But it's the concept that he doesn't have anybody in his life, and he meets this nice girl who is studying to be a nun, practically. Her dad wants to send her away because he doesn't want her to be corrupted, but she understands him. And it all comes from a scene where he's wearing a glove on his hand that should not yep. fit. Do you think this is Brando's best film?
I've only seen a couple of his movies. I've seen this one and Streetcar Named Desire. Probably two of his most well-known, of course, besides The Godfather. And I honestly don't know that I've seen enough of his movies to make that call. Like I said, I feel like he does a really good job with it, and it is a great performance. But so is Streetcar. I thought he did well in both of them. Very different characters.
Really comes down to this in Streetcar. I think he did some of his best work with Elia Kazan, and he got it out of the way, because I would mm-hmm. say that a lot of his movies after that did not have him playing. Brando's a very frustrating character in cinema history mm-hmm. because he was so afraid of being labeled as a pretty boy. He did not yeah. want to be known for his face.
Such a nice face.
It was such a nice face. And actually, throw out conspiracy theories, the argument is that Brando let himself go as he got older as a response to the fact that he didn't want to be responsible for keeping his look and being this
appearance.
Exactly. I have not seen everything in his filmography, but I have seen a fair amount of stuff from his early work as he got older. I still give the edge to Streetcar because I think that's a great movie that everything works well. But if we're talking about Brando holding a performance on his shoulders, it's this. I would say this is probably his best role. I can't think of any other movie where he is responsible for the success of that film. You look at something like Guys and Dolls. That doesn't work because Marlon Brando's in it. That's just a really weird facet of the movie. And I guess somebody could argue maybe Apocalypse Now is his best role, which I haven't seen.
I haven't either.
I'm going to say this is probably his best role. I won't say it's his best film. I do think Streetcar is his best film.
I will agree with that.
It's amazing that he, in just the early 50s, came out of the gate after doing stage with this, and to include Viva Zapata, talk about brown face, Julius Caesar, The Wild One on the Waterfront. That is a serious group of titles to get out just in a couple of years. He is the youngest actor to win Best Actor at 30 years old at the time. The current record holder right now is Adrian Brody at 29. There are rumors that we might get our youngest winner this year if Timothée Chalamet wins. It reminds you of how the Oscars, and I don't know how often you watch the Oscars, if it's a yearly thing for you, Casey, but I always get annoyed that 30 is the youngest actor to win. And I'm pretty sure you could say actress is far younger. We assume actresses peak at 30, and you don't get your first Oscar for Best Actor until you are at least 45. We assume men age into that.
Right.
Whereas Brando just got it at 30.
Yeah, I mean, he was still a baby. He was very fresh into everything, and essentially the highest honor at the Oscars.
And we should keep in mind, he had been nominated before this 3 times.
Oh, wow.
At the beginning of his career. It is mind-boggling. He got nominated right out the gate in 52 for Streetcar. Then he got nominated in 53 for Viva Zapata. Then he got nominated in 54 for Julius Caesar, and then he won in 55. I'm sure somebody can tell me that somebody else has that many nominations before a win, but that close together? Wow. Yeah, and then he was nominated again in 58 and then won again in 73, although he infamously did not take the award in 73 when he won for The Godfather. And he was nominated 2 more times after that. It's insane. His career just defies expectation. Let's talk about another person in this group that I think is worth talking about. Maybe even best Brando in this movie. Carl Malden, who plays Father Barry. He is the one that's trying to organize everything and convince Terry and the other longshoremen to testify in this trial. I love Carl Malden. Carl Malden always reminds me of, like, the dad or grandpa you wish you had.
Yeah, definitely.
Even when he's playing a lech, like in Baby Doll, if anybody's ever seen that movie. If you love Carl Malden, don't actually watch that movie because he plays such a creep. But he's good. He's so good. Carl Malden, unlike Marlon Brando, only nominated for an Academy Award twice. Had won in 1952 for playing in Streetcar Named Desire. This was his last Oscar nomination. It's a bit sad that he didn't win for a role that I think is better than his performance in Streetcar. I mean, he's great in Streetcar, but he's so good in this. What did you think about him?
He was really good. He was very convincing in his role. He's the peacekeeper. He's the guy who's trying to, like you said, get everyone together and overthrow the tyrants and just try to get everything calm and, in his eyes, right. What he thinks is the right thing to do, he's trying to convince Brando's character to do the right thing. He does really well with it, and it's a really great performance, especially his speech at the dock. It sucks you in and just makes you think.
And he's definitely, for lack of a better word, he's the voice of God. He's the priest who's trying to put Terry on the straight and narrow. You can't get any better than Carl Malden, really.
Can't imagine anyone else playing the role.
And I couldn't find anybody else who had been offered the role. So I think it might have been Malden or Butts. I'm glad that you brought up his speech at the docks, because I think that that makes this his career best. Carl Malden had such a long and lengthy career, and he did television, and he did film, and he did stage. He did everything. He was making TV shows and working up until the 2000s. That's an insane body of work, and I honestly don't think, and I haven't seen enough of his films to probably make this assertion, but I think this is his best film. I think this is best performance. I'm sure somebody can tell me that, oh, you haven't seen this and he's amazing in it. I'm sure that's true. Even the worst movie has a great Carl Malden performance in it. So we got a segue to Our Lady, Eva Marie Saint. I love Eva so much.
She's such a sweetheart.
Have you been near her and you didn't tell me?
No. I would tell you. I would so tell you. No, I just mean her interactions when I saw On the Waterfront at TCM with her introduction. She's hilarious. Her and Ben together it's adorable. She just seems like the nicest person you could ever meet.
If anybody's heard that story about her and Ben Mankiewicz doing the interview and how she complained that he was wearing jeans.
He took his pants off.
Exactly. Eva Marie Saint made Ben Mankiewicz take his pants off.
It was great.
Good for her. We talked about this a little bit when we talked about Natalie Wood in West Side Story, but got a lot of older people playing younger than they are. Eva Marie Saint was 30 playing 19.
You would never know.
She looks flawless. And I think she is the picture-perfect embodiment of the nun. Mm-hmm. I don't think we give her enough credit, because you could easily see her as a Grace Kelly knockoff. Both women have very blonde hair, and they're both picture-perfect. What makes Eva Marie Saint better than someone like Grace Kelly is that she has this approachable quality to her. What did you think of her in this movie? I find it disgusting, personally, that on IMDb, she is billed last on their credits. Throwing that out there, IMDb, what the heck?
I think she's really great. She plays that character really well. I had no idea that she was 30 years old in this movie. Like you said, she looks phenomenal. She's got the qualities that are needed for this role. I can't imagine anyone else being able to talk to Terry the way that she does, Brando's character. I can't imagine anyone else being able to essentially love him like she does and care about him. It's a really great performance. And again, I haven't seen a lot of her movies. I think the only other one was North by Northwest.
I was going to say, I think that's about it for me. Maybe something that she's done recently. I did see Winter's Tale.
It's just a great performance for all involved. I think they did a really great job with the casting and with the on-screen chemistry between her and Brando is just perfect.
And I know we groused about the chemistry between Richard Beamer and Natalie Wood last time, but the chemistry here between these two is just on fire.
100%.
And it's remarkably chaste. They only kiss once, I think, right before the big third act confrontation. And it is this rough wooing where they're fighting and then he kisses her and she's like not into it, but it's Brando and it's 1954. So she slowly becomes a fan.
I mean, friend that I was watching it with was just yelling that whole time. She's like, that is right. And I'm just like, no.
It was very funny. I was just having this conversation about the recent issues that we're having with the Me Too movement and how you watch old movies and that's par for the course. No means convince me and shove her up against the wall. And it's definitely problematic. Does it diminish my love of older movies? No, it doesn't. Or else I wouldn't be able to enjoy them.
Yeah, same.
That was Brando's specialty. Streetcar actually does have a rape in it, but
it does.
It's more of the fact that like they're both angry. They're both upset. Brando's Terry just doesn't really know what to do. He's not really good with taking signals and realizing time and place.
They do have a more romantic kiss on the roof.
I know I was forgetting something.
And it's very sweet. I think that comes before that kiss. They've already kissed, so it's not as terrible. I feel like if it was the first kiss, it would be a little odd. Not weird to me.
You're waiting for the other shoe to drop throughout their entire relationship because you know, the audience knows, that Brando is responsible for the death of her brother in some way. If anything, she's a bit too forgiving for me.
A little bit.
I was sitting there thinking, I know he didn't shove him off the roof, but he did get him up there. But it's Eva. She never picks the right man. If you look at North by Northwest.
Cary Grant.
You know, as much as I love Cary Grant, North by Northwest, I would have stuck with James Mason, personally.
Always pick Cary Grant.
Any other time, again, this doesn't sound any, it sounds weird to me, too, but we should say Grace Kelly actually turned this down. I thought I was just comparing them because they looked similar. No, I actually forgot I wrote a note here. This is Grace Kelly turned this role down.
That's why you were talking about it.
And this actually came down to Eva Marie Saint and Elizabeth Montgomery. Before she did Bewitched. Mm-hmm. And Elizabeth Montgomery, they felt, was too polished. And I think that that's where Grace Kelly wouldn't have worked, because she is the apotheosis of polished and refined. I think what makes Eva Marie Saint work is that she's down to earth. What do you think? Could you see anybody else playing this role?
No, out of the two mentioned, definitely not. I think Elizabeth Montgomery has the innocence. She would be able to play the innocent part of it. Grace Kelly could not play innocent at all. In most of her movies, she's pursuing someone. I guess I'm just thinking about To Catch a Thief and her and Cary Grant. And let's not get into that.
But, I haven't seen that movie. I need to.
Oh, no, you really need to. It's so good. Like I said, I think Elizabeth Montgomery could have done it not as good. She could not have done it as well as Eva Marie Saint. And Grace Kelly, I love her. She's fantastic and she's gorgeous. But one, they couldn't make her look 19. And two, she cannot play a nun.
No, I had a hard time believing Audrey Hepburn as a nun. I definitely couldn't believe Grace Kelly. But I think Elizabeth Montgomery would have been interesting, because I wonder what would have happened if she was a bigger film star. Would we have gotten Bewitched? Because I love Bewitched, and I love Elizabeth Montgomery so much. They campaigned Eva Marie Saint's character as a supporting role. She won the Supporting Actress Oscar. Do you consider her a supporting character? Now, there are two schools of thought here. That lead actress is either, if you're the sole woman in the film, then you're lead, or you have to actually be on par with the leading man in terms of screen time and significance to the story. Do you think that this was quote unquote category fraud for her to win as supporting actress?
There's not really any other females in the movie.
There's none.
Yeah, there's like the random older lady that says a few lines, but she's just there as filler. She's playing someone's mom. So in that sense, yes. But if you're looking at it the other way, then no. I think it is a supporting role. But if you're just looking at if there's only one woman, then yeah, she should have gotten the lead. I don't completely disagree with the supporting role. No.
It's a common thing that happens in a lot of movies, even to this day, so this is nothing new, but I really don't. I think she is just as significant as Brando is in this movie. Mauldin got supporting actor nomination. This is really an ensemble film. Everybody, with the exception of maybe Rod Steiger and Lee J. Cobb, are about on screen for an equal amount of time. Brando's in every frame, literally. I always feel that she should have gone lead. It's often harder, though. You have more stiff competition if you campaign it lead. The argument is it's often easier to get a supporting, like we did with West Side Story. Won 8 Oscars, nominated in several categories. It won Best Picture, Best Actor, Supporting Actress, Director, Screenplay, Cinematography, Art Direction, and Editing. Was nominated 3 separate times in Supporting Actor, which is the worst thing you can do, because preferential ballots end up splitting the votes, and then you go to like a really weird 5 categories, 3 are held by one movie. So Lee J. Cobb, Carl Mauldin, Rod Steiger were all nominated for supporting, and then Bernstein's music, which we're going to get back to Bernstein in a second. On the Waterfront was pretty well represented. I should say 3 actors from this movie nominated supporting actor. The winner ended up being Edmund O'Brien for The Barefoot Contessa, which sounds a bit more realistic. And if Tom Tully had won for The Caine Mutiny, that would have been like a Jeopardy question that no one would ever get. Who won the 1954 Best Supporting Actor? That was also the year that Grace Kelly won for Best Actress for The Country Girl, otherwise known as the Oscar she didn't deserve. I'm sorry. I'm always going to be Team Judy. Should have been Judy for A Star is Born. Although, that's actually a pretty amazing lineup of actresses in 54. I'll throw it out there briefly because I think we have time. But it was Grace Kelly for The Country Girl, Audrey Hepburn for Sabrina, Dorothy Dandridge for Carmen Jones, which she was the first African-American nominated for leading actress, Jane Wyman for Magnificent Obsession and Judy Garland for A Star Is Born. God, I can't argue with any of those. Those are all amazing performances, all amazing movies.
They really are.
But Judy should have won, damn it. Eva Marie Saint won for supporting actress. I can't really argue. She is the best, I would say, out of everybody who was nominated. Do you think it deserved picture? Let's just throw out really briefly what was best picture that year. It was On the Waterfront, The Caine Mutiny, Three Coins in the Fountain, The Country Girl, and Seven Brides for Seven Brothers. What a weird combination of titles. Do you think it deserved best picture?
I do. I think that when you combine the story, the cast, we've talked a lot about the cast, and they are phenomenal together. I don't know about the subcontext of it with the Hueck. I don't think that that really matters. But, you know, the message that it's sending across, when you take everything and put it together, I do think it deserved Best Picture. I've tried to watch Seven Brides for Seven Brothers, but dear Lord, I could not last through like the first 10 minutes.
I have not seen that movie. I love musicals, but I have not seen that movie. And I'm wondering if there's a reason.
There is a reason. I'm sure a lot of people love that movie. I am not one of them. It's the only one that I've seen the full movie of the ones that were up for Best Picture. Even just looking at it, I would have to say that it deserves it.
If you're just looking at that 1954, 1955, there was no other movie that was going to win it. People, I'm sure, knew that it was about Hueck. I'm sure. They could not say that it wasn't. I think this is an example of them rewarding the fall of communism, regardless of quality. I definitely think if we're comparing it to all those other movies, quality-wise, yes, it deserved the Oscar. But I think if you're talking about the internal politicking of the Academy Awards, which, when it all boils down to it, is all about politicking and nominations and campaigning, it had to win. I find it funny that, once again, a movie that was nominated that year was another Stanley Kramer movie. We talked about Judgment at Nuremberg being the big movie to beat in 61 when West Side Story won everything. And here it's the Caine Mutiny.
Yeah.
Before we close out, we got to talk about Bernstein. This is the only film, not a musical, that he worked on. He composed the score. What did you think about the music, especially knowing that he created this four film, unlike something like West Side Story?
I think it was well done. There were points on the roof that I recall specifically where the music is very intense and you know that something's about to happen. You keep expecting Brando to get, well, I kept expecting Brando to get shot, to be perfectly honest. I think he did well with it. I think he hit the points that needed to be hit. I think he did a good job.
I'm going to say I definitely think the Leonard Bernstein score here is great. It is impossible to watch the film and not feel that power that comes from his composition. The final scenes when Terry's walking towards the camera and he's all beaten and there's just this pounding drum that is almost like a heartbeat. Utterly amazing. He uses so much horns and music. It's this fierce pounding clash of strings. But he's also able to, especially in the scenes with Terry and Edie, even Marie Saint's character, there's this nice little, like, it almost sounds like a flute or a harp that plays. So he's able to definitely create tone and mood. Compared to West Side Story, where he's dealing with cultures, it's nice that he's able to show people. I wish he had done more for film. He did not want to go Hollywood. And I wish that he had, because he always felt that he never got the recognition that he wanted from his contemporaries. And I think maybe had he dabbled more in film, sadly, I don't think most people would listen to the score over West Side Story. Different mediums. Some final thoughts. Overall, what do you think about On the Waterfront, Casey? Do you recommend it?
If you're into film, and classic film especially, or history at all, I do recommend it. It's the same way I feel about Streetcar Named Desire. It's not something that I will watch several times, but I think it's very important to watch, especially in the sense of classic film. If you want to learn about film and how it should be done, then you need to watch it.
I definitely recommend Waterfront at least once, because so much of appreciating film today is appreciating where we've been. And you can't look at film today without looking at their political context. I think no movie represents its political context and what was going on in Hollywood at the time than On the Waterfront. watch this alongside something like High Noon, which is also comment on HUAC. As you get into a lot of the movies of the early to mid-50s, you're going to get some type of HUAC message, especially once the sci-fi boom comes up. You know, something like Invasion of the Body Snatchers, there are arguments that it's about HUAC. Definitely think it's well acted. The ensemble's brilliant. The score is great. I'm sad that Bernstein did not win for that score. It does leave you a bit removed, especially if you don't know the history. You might feel it's a bit slow, it's a bit plodding, but it's worth it. So you can send me your thoughts about On the Waterfront or Leonard Bernstein or Marlon Brando. Tell me if I'm wrong that I'm not watching the right Marlon Brando or Carl Malden films to judge his best performance. You can email your thoughts to me at ticklishbiz@gmail.com and I will read them on the next episode. I'd like to thank Casey Kilmer once again for joining me on this two-episode retrospective of Leonard Bernstein. Casey, where can fans find and learn more about you?
You can find me on my music page most frequently. It's just Casey Kilmer Music. I do have a classic film blog called Hepburnia, like the Hepburns, but I'm not on there terribly often, so music page is probably the best place. I'm on Twitter as just KCK11.
That'll close out this edition of Ticklish Business. You can listen to Ticklish Business a multitude of ways, either at ticklishbusiness.podbean.com, via Stitcher Radio and Player FM, or on iTunes. If you are listening via iTunes and you like what you hear, please consider leaving a rating or review. As always, you can contact me directly with questions, comments, suggestions at ticklishbiz, that's B-I-Z, @gmail.com, or visit me at my official website where I discuss classic films regularly, journeysinclassicfilm.com. And the podcast is also on Twitter at ticklish_biz. Want to learn more about upcoming episodes or hear exclusive content before anyone else? Then consider supporting Ticklish Business via Patreon. I have a wealth of amazing perks, and all your donations go right back into making Ticklish Business the premier classic film podcast. If you're interested in becoming a patron or you want to see what's available, you can head over to patreon.com/ticklishbiz. Want to learn more about the stars turning 100 this year? If you're a member of TCM's exclusive fan club, TCM Backlot, you can read my series about the stars spotlighted on the podcast, talking films and information that you won't hear on the episodes. Next time, though, Lauren Humphreys-Brooks is going to join me for the month of February to help celebrate our centennial star, Ida Lupino, as we start by looking at one of her acting roles in the 1946 period drama, Devotion. Till next time.